Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Mexico City to speak with veteran correspondent Dudley Althaus, the senior correspondent in Mexico for Global Post, where he has an article, Mexico's Zetas Boss Nabbed, Cue the Brutal Backlash. We'll discuss the capture of one of Mexico's most wanted men and whether this will spur the rival Sinaloa cartel to seize control of the Zetas drug smuggling routes into the United States. Then we will speak with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who is an expert on Russia at the Brookings Institution, where he served as special assistant to the president and senior director of Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia at the National Security Council. We'll discuss the 5-year jail sentence of Russia's charismatic young anti-corruption crusader Alexei Navalny, who Putin is afraid could be a potential opposition leader, so is railroading him on trumped-up charges to prevent Navalny from running for mayor of Moscow. Then finally, with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs acknowledging today that currently the tide seems to have shifted in Assad's favor in Syria, we will look into calls from key senators who are pressuring Obama to use force to defeat Assad as the Syrian opposition loses ground and shows deepening signs of division. Henri Barki, who served as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, joins us to assess the increasingly bloody stalemate that has the U.S. and its allies dithering while Syria burns. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dudley Althaus, who is the Global Post senior correspondent in Mexico and Central America. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dudley Althaus.
Good afternoon, Ian.
And so in your article, Mexico's Zetas Boss Nabbed, Cue the Brutal Backlash, you indicate that maybe the Zetas, who really don't, in effect, deal in drugs, they just control the drug routes, the corridors, if you will, and that there's a possibility that the Sinaloa cartel will now make its move. So how can the Mexican authorities and the new president be celebrating such a great victory when it sounds like this is just round one in a continually brutal battle?
Well, the Zetas were particularly brutal, and I think that gang in particular had really upped the ante as far as brutality in Mexico. When the Zetas first appeared on the scene and really got to be going in about 7-8 years ago, the level of brutality they brought to the game really forced the other gangs to really up their game, if you will. The Zetas used the original founders of the Zetas were Mexican military guys, special forces that deserted, and they really used paramilitary guerrilla warfare tactics against both the government and their enemies. So I think, and when they took over towns in Mexico, they were particularly brutal on the local population as well. So I think this is a victory, even though it's not going to stop drug trafficking.
And the group that took them down appears to be the tip of the spear now in this new war on drugs, if indeed that's what it is, under Peña Nieto's new government of the PRI. The Mexican Navy Special Forces, which you say are 400 highly trained men stationed in rapid response bases around the country, as well as an 1,800-strong Marine Brigade based in Mexico City. And they apparently work closely with the United States. Is that to say that the U.S. is leery of the Mexican army, who apparently are feeling marginalized?
Well, yeah, so that's been going on for quite a while. That first came out with the WikiLeaks memos from the U.S. Embassy criticizing the Mexican army back in 2009, 2010. The Navy was always much closer to the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy trusted them and used them as their kind of go-to kind of operational guys. And that was put on, the Navy was kind of put on the back burner, at least publicly, by Peña Nieto in the past 6-7 months. But I think the fact that these guys did take down this capo, this guy, Zeta 40, pretty much much indicates they're back in the game, and the U.S. is probably back in the game as well.
And when
everyone's downplaying the U.S. Involvement in this, but I think it's right there. I mean, I think that this could not have happened with some serious U.S. involvement, U.S. intelligence, perhaps and probably including drone surveillance on the border.
So when the drug lord that was captured, Miguel Angel Trevino, is called Z-40, and his brother who's taking over, Omar, is Z-42, is that a number that's assigned by law enforcement, or do they call themselves by in that code?
They call themselves by that code. Those are former kind of radio call signals for military call signals. And the SETAs, the original SETAs, the military guys called each other by the Z code. You know, the original founder, original boss of the SETAs was Z1, Z2 was his underling, and so on down the line. The fact that Trevino Z40 kind of shows you they've been working, kind of whittling down the list of leaders, huh?
And apparently the Mexican Marines last October killed Heriberto Lascano.
Lascano,
yeah.
Yes.
And that was Trevino's predecessor, right?
Yes, and Lascano was one of the original founders. He was a Special Forces corporal who deserted with the rest of them. There was a group of about 14 or 15 guys who first deserted and worked as bodyguards for the Gulf Cartel. The Gulf Cartel is one of the old-line gangster groups in Mexico, based out of the city of Matamoros, which is on the Texas border right at the mouth of the Rio Grande. The SETAs were formed to work as the bodyguards of the boss of the Gulf Cartel back in the late 90s and kind of separated from the Gulf Cartel about 5 years ago, but really separated 3 years ago and went to war with the Gulf Cartel. But Lascano, yes, was killed not far from where they just captured Trevino, not far in Mexico or Texas terms, a few hundred miles, I think, but also by the Mexican Marines. The Navy says they were just a regular patrol, but I would imagine they were probably special forces as well.
And this was close to the border, was it not?
It's pretty close to the border. It's about 150 miles south,
mm-hmm.
But in the high country, cold country of the Mexican border state of Coahuila.
So
he was actually killed in also by himself with just several bodyguards, which is very unusual for these guys. They usually travel in really big convoys of bodyguards. And he had attended a local baseball game in a very small town, and the Marines caught up with him as he was leaving the baseball game and shot him dead.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dudley Althaus, who is a Global Post senior correspondent for Mexico and Central America. He's based in Mexico City, where he is now, and he has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. So you pose the question, though, in your article at Global Post, there's a possibility that the Sinaloa cartel, headed by Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who's obviously an incredible survivor, he'd been around for a long time. The Arellano Felix people tried to kill him back in the 1980s, I recall. He and the Gulf cartel are going to get together, do you think, and take over Zetas territory? That's how they operate, isn't it? They don't actually bring the drugs in and ship them into the United States. They basically just control corridors and extort people to cross the corridors, whether they're bringing drugs or immigrants or whatever.
Well, that's the way the Zetas work. The Zetas, they've gotten into drug trafficking in recent months and year, in the past couple of years, perhaps. But they're not; they don't have the expertise to say the Sinaloa cartel or the old line drug trafficking groups out of Mexico. They never did. So they have gotten a little bit more contacts in Colombia, but not that many, from what I know. The Sinaloa cartel tried to take over the SETA main base in Nuevo Laredo on the border with Laredo, Texas, which is the biggest land bridge between Mexico and the United States, the most important land bridge. Back in 2004, 2005, there were hundreds killed in that war, which really kind of set off the hyperviolence where Mexico is still experiencing today, 9 years later. Chapo Guzman and the Sinaloa cartel lost that battle. They pulled out. they came back in the past year, allied with the Gulf cartel. And I don't think it's not just possible. I think it's probable they're going to try to move in on this territory now. I think Nuevo Laredo is definitely going to be a hot spot. And the city of Monterrey, which is the third largest city of Mexico, where the Gulf cartel and the SETS has been battling for 2 or 3 years now, is definitely a hot spot.
But it's hardly a coincidence that these hot spots, and Nuevo Laredo apparently is one of the highest death rates in Mexico, and yet across the border on the American side, I think there's only been one death in this year, and El Paso, Texas is the safest city in the United States. So that's kind of surreal that they're literally across the bridge from each other. And yet here we are pouring billions into border security on this side. But it's hardly an accident that this violence is taking place right on the Mexican border, because these are corridors to get drugs into the United States. We are the customers, are we not?
That's right. Much of this, I mean, there's been a tremendous increase in local Mexican consumption of drugs. But, yeah, this is basically about getting drugs to U.S. consumers. And that's why the Mexican border towns are so rough. You're right about the U.S. border cities being among the safest in the United States. It's an incredible paradox, and I think it goes right to the heart of the rule of law. If you kill somebody in El Paso or you kill somebody in Laredo, your chances of getting caught and prosecuted and convicted are pretty high. On the Mexican side, they're not very high at all. I think these border communities share the gangsters. They share the drug trade. They share the profits from the drug trade. What they don't share is the deaths.
So is that to suggest that there is not so much equal, but there's a lot of corruption on our side? It's just not as violent?
Well, yeah, I don't know how much corruption there is on our side. I think they strongly prosecuted on the U.S. side. I mean, certainly there's corruption on both sides of the border. There's been a number of arrests of Border Patrol and customs people and others and sheriffs, local sheriffs, deputies on the U.S. side. But I think that, you know, I think the corruption that allows these people to operate freely on the Mexican side in a big way. And it certainly let this problem grow tremendously.
So
I think if both things were equal on both sides of the border, you'd see bloodshed on both sides of the border.
Well, that's what's interesting, what I'm trying to get my head around here, Dudley Althaus, is why it is that where the customers, where they make their money, and it's illegal on this side of the border. But there's so much less mayhem, even though in a very real sense, we're morally responsible, are we not? Because we're the ones that generate the money.
Yeah, I think definitely. There's, you know, a colleague of mine, an NPR reporter that was here a few years ago working here, and had previously worked in Africa, brought up a really good point. He said, you know, everybody was so concerned about blood diamonds. This is blood cocaine. This is blood marijuana. And if you're doing cocaine or you're smoking some Mexican pot right now, apart from the argument of whether it should be legal or not be legal in the United States, you have a piece of this. You have a piece of this mayhem.
So what's your sense then, Dudley Althaus, in Mexico City, of the new pre-leader's government and his different approach to the war on drugs? There was a great deal of concern that the PRI, because of their history of cohabiting and being in bed with so much organized crime, that might be the route that he's taking. But so far, it looks like he's more effective in terms of the military style interdiction. But whether or not that's going to address the broader issues of drug trafficking, I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of doubts about Peña, and I don't think that one arrest are going to allay those doubts about how serious they're going to be about taking on the drug trade. What Peña said since from the beginning during his campaign last year, that he's going to concentrate on the crimes that most affect ordinary Mexicans, which are kidnapping, extortion, murder, murder of common citizens, simple assault, an array of vices. and really kind of dial back on the militarized drug war. Now, that's what he wanted to do. I think that this arrest demonstrates that he's turning back, at least for now. I mean, we'll see what happens, to rely on the military again and to rely again on the Navy Special Forces. That's not to say they're not using the Army, and that's the Army plays a very important role here. But for these kind of specialized operations, I mean, these guys, Rand, if you believe the government version, and it sounds pretty right to me, they ran down this guy on a back road with a helicopter, and then, you know, got guys off the helicopter and had other guys waiting for him down the road, other Marines, other special forces, who had night vision goggles on. This is a very specialized group. They knew exactly where he was going to be at exactly what time, and they took him without a shot fired. That's not the same thing as what we've been experiencing with the military having full-scale shootouts in the street with gangsters in villages and towns all across northern Mexico. So I think maybe this indicates that Peña Nieto's switching gears a little bit, and we'll see what happens. I mean, this just happened, and it could be a one-off, or it could be a trend. We're going to have to just see.
Well, of course, on this side of the border, a federal court in Austin in May convicted one of this drug lord's brothers, Jose, of laundering millions of dollars of gang profits through a large racehorse farm in Oklahoma. So it would seem that there's a lot more that can be done on this side of the border. As we've mentioned, this is where the money comes from, and apparently it's all bundled up and shipped south. You know, short of legalizing it or medicalizing the problem and getting rid of the money, is what's the Mexican position? Is that where surely they must be saying, and they've been saying for some time, haven't they? We're the ones who are bleeding and dying in this damn war.
Well, that's exactly right. You went right to the point of it, and that goes to the border security issue that you brought up earlier as well. For all the talk of violence and spillover, there's a little bit on the U.S. side, but very little. The real spillover to me, and my colleague and friend Ginger Thompson wrote the stories about the horse racing, his brother being involved in horse racing. And she pointed out in her articles in May that, in fact, these guys, people that dealt with Miguel Angel Treviño's brother, Jose, knew exactly who he was. And they're still dealing, they're still selling horses, multi-million dollar horses and that sort of thing. To me, that's the real spillover, that sort of complicity among, you know, business people or sports people or whatever. That's complicity, and that's the real spillover. You're kind of abetting these guys. And so, yeah, I think your point's well taken. I mean, I think it's very – the Mexicans blame the United States for buying the drugs, which is fair enough. The U.S. citizens, well, many people in the United States – blame Mexico for allowing the drugs to be trafficked. It's really a shared responsibility, right?
Right.
And you're right. The Mexicans are providing the bodies.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dudley Althaus.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dudley Althaus, who is the Global Post senior correspondent for Mexico and Central America. He's based in Mexico City, and he's covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investments. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Putin has jailed a potential rival.
Somos víctimas de un estado confiscado con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México.
Когда пройдет дождь, тот, что уймет нас, когда уйдет день над твоей землей, я проснусь здесь, пусть я проснусь здесь, в долгой траве, рядом с тобой.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thanks for having me.
And today, the Russian protest leader, Alexei Navalny, was jailed for corruption in what was a clearly trumped-up charge of embezzlement. And I don't think there's anybody much in the world, except perhaps in the Kremlin, that sees this as anything but a show trial and political persecution. So is this isolating Putin even further? He's got the Snowden case on his lap, which is irritating the United States. And then you have this flagrant action today with Navalny. And then prior to that, of course, there was the adding insult to injury where the Magnitsky case came back to haunt us. And even though the poor man was dead, they charged him. So this is all beginning to look to me like President Obama's trip to Moscow in September may be in jeopardy.
Well, first of all, I would separate the Snowden case off from the other problems that you've talked about, and certainly the Navalny trial, by any objective assessment, was a farce. The main prosecution witness had cut a plea bargain so that he could avoid jail time. The person contradicted himself in his testimony. Navalny's lawyers were not allowed to cross-examine him, and they were not allowed to call defense witnesses. So this was a farce, and it's unfortunately part of a broader effort by the Kremlin really to crank down and tamp down on dissent and opposition. And I think it reflects a basic insecurity on the part of the Kremlin. The Snowden case, I would see something as different. My sense is with regards to Snowden, there's a certain ambivalence there. For some people, certainly I think they see an advantage in being able to exploit Snowden for public relations purposes. Intelligence people in Moscow certainly would like to have a lot of time to talk to him. But I think there are others who also see Snowden's presence in Moscow as a distraction. But it's different from what's going on, unfortunately, in terms of political repression within Russia.
Well, let's stick with political repression then, because this is one of the most prominent opposition leaders, and he is going to be doing 5 years in jail. And we already have the Pussy Riot girls in jail. We have Khodorkovsky, the billionaire who was stripped of his oil company, and he's been indefinitely in prison. We know that these prisons are just hideous. I mean, as bad as our prisons are, their prisons are rife with tuberculosis and brutality and tremendous isolation, you know, in these gulags in Siberia, etc. So do you detect a level of disgust at what's happening in Russia, not so much in the Narod, who still seem to support Putin, but amongst the intelligentsia? Is there a certain point, you think, where they're going to come back on the streets, or have they been successfully corralled and intimidated by Putin?
Yeah, well, I think you've asked an extremely important question here, which is, I mean, ultimately, as much as we in the West can be unhappy about the deterioration of democracy in Russia, it's the Russian people who have to speak for themselves. And Navalny, I think, has a following. It was interesting that there was a poll conducted in the last several days which showed that only a quarter of Russians thought his trial was a legitimate trial. Others thought it was either politically motivated or designed to keep him from running in the mayoral race for Moscow. But the question is, does that unhappiness, does that translate into some kind of a pushback? My guess is that Mr. Putin and the Kremlin are betting that they can contain these things, that with some effort on their part, they can push back against people like Navalny, that the demonstrations will not be large, and then they can ride this out. I mean, this all reflects, to my mind, a certain insecurity on the part of the Kremlin. But the question is, how does the Russian public respond to this? And we don't yet know.
So in terms of the Snowden case, which you feel, well, it's obviously separate, but that, I think, is something that is really an irritant between the White House and the Kremlin, surely. And there are reports now that President Obama may put off his trip. When you mentioned the intelligence people, of course, you know, Putin himself is a former KGB officer, and there's some speculation. I talked to a Time magazine's correspondent in Moscow recently who said that the consensus in Moscow has always been, and he's talked to a lot of intelligence officials there as much as you can, talked to both former and current. He said that the consensus there is that Snowden has never been in that airport. He's always been held at a kind of KGB dacha, or now the SVR, and that he's being debriefed, and this is what this is all about. And apparently he has an enormous amount of information with him, but it's all encoded and encrypted, and I guess the challenge is to get him to give up the passwords. Do you think that that's what's really going on here?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I think that there are certainly people in the Russian SVR, the successor of the KGB, who would like to have that access. And this is a distraction, but I think, though, that both sides understand how the game is played. And in the past, and this goes back decades, the United States and Russia have been very good at compartmentalizing and fencing off these sorts of issues, the questions of people like Snowden, defectors, spies. Go back just 3 years ago, 2010, when the reset was still, I think, viewed very positively. There was a good relationship between Obama and Medvedev, and we still arrested and expelled 10 Russians. And nobody would think about that now, except one of the Russians arrested happened to be a rather attractive young lady. I'd go back to in 1986 when I was serving at the American Embassy in Moscow, and that was a time when you could begin to see a very positive relationship develop between President Reagan and General Secretary Gorbachev, and it led within a year to the treaty banning medium-range missiles. But at the same time, in September and October of 1986, we expelled 80 Soviet diplomats from Washington and New York. So the sides in the past are pretty good about fencing this off. If there's going to be a question about the Moscow-Summit or broader relations, it's not going to be driven by Snowden. And I guess one last comment is, people here in Washington, they understand that there is zero chance that the Russians would arrest and return Snowden to Washington. Because this fits in exactly with Putin's KGB background. Were they to do that, what message do they send to any potential defector or anybody else that would be of intelligence interest? That's not the message that they would want to send, and Putin understands that. So he's not coming back to the United States from Moscow. The best thing is that if the Russians move him on to a third country where he becomes a distraction to a different bilateral relationship.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russia. He served as a special assistant to the president and senior director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. So clearly, I mentioned the others that are in jail and the Magnitsky case, which irritates the Kremlin, as did an earlier iteration the Jackson-Vanik Amendment back in the Soviet days. What was your response to, what's your reaction to the posthumous sentencing of Magnitsky? I mean, why rub salt in that wound?
No, that I think is a good question. I don't have a good answer on that. I mean, again, it seemed to me just to display a very bizarre aspect of the Russian legal system. I do not have a way of calculating what kind of domestic political benefit that the Russian government saw from that, and certainly the reaction that they generated overseas was very predictable and very negative.
So I've talked to some Russian experts and Russian expatriates about Putin over the years, trying to get a picture of who he is. And Nina Khrushcheva in New York was telling me recently that, and this may be just, again, the intelligentsia speaking as opposed to the Narod, but she was saying that this big show that he's putting on in Sochi for the Olympics may be his sort of zenith, his pinnacle, and it's going to be downhill from there. And there is an element, at least in, maybe it's wishful thinking on the part of the opposition, that the emperor's clothes are sort of coming off, that his divorce, his affair with this gymnast. At the recent press conference where he talked about Snowden and said that it may seem strange coming from my lips, but I don't want to upset our American partners and I don't want to do any damage to American partners, which he reiterated at his more recent press conference. That prompted giggles and guffaws from a lot of the reporters there who are Russian. So do you detect that the strong man is fraying?
Well, again, I interpret a lot of the signs over the last year and a half of the political crackdown as showing a basic insecurity on the part of Putin and the Kremlin regarding political developments within Russia. And it was triggered primarily by the large demonstrations that came out in December of 2011 following elections that many Russians saw as not fully fair. So I think that is where Putin is coming from on this. And there is that level of insecurity. And it's probably bolstered by the fact that when he looks at opinion polls, there's a paradox. And that is that most opinion polls consistently show that Vladimir Putin is by far the most popular politician, the most popular figure in Russia. And approval ratings in the 50-60% very easily achieved. But by the same token, the polls show that a majority of Russians don't want to see him run again for president in 2018, which suggests to me that for most Russians, he's beginning to pass his shelf date, and they would like to see him move on. Now, Sochi is a particularly interesting example because you have there the Winter Olympics there that have cost an estimated $50 to $55 billion a stage, by far the most expensive Olympics in history. Lots of reports of corruption, huge corruption there. And those reports are sort of bouncing around on the internet in Russia. And I think people are beginning to sort of scratch their heads about this kind of corruption and this kind of show. And this is very much seen as something very close to Putin. And that could be a problem for him.
So, Ambassador Pfeiffer, when former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev calls this verdict against Navalny very depressing, and he wrote on his website, "Unfortunately, this confirms that we don't have an independent court system." Now, of course, Gorbachev is not an influential figure in Russia. He's much more popular in the West than he is in Russia. But nevertheless, I'm just wondering how pervasive this sense amongst Russians are that the courts are rigged and that there's no justice there.
Yeah, no, I think most Russians who follow this questions are pretty aware of the court system. What was interesting to me was that immediately after the Navalny verdict was announced, the Moscow stock market tanked. I think it lost 1.5% of its value on its main indices. And that's actually logical because for business, what business wants to have is a predictable, fair, unbiased court system. And so even though the Kremlin in this case used the court system in a political way, that lack of confidence in the court system is one of the things that holds back business and holds back foreign investment in Russia. And so, again, I think most Russians who follow this question understand that the legal system is very easily subject to political manipulation by the Kremlin. The question, though, that remains is, are they going to translate that unhappiness? Does that manifest it in some way that begins to lead to a broader push up by the Russian public for a more independent judiciary? Will they push back up to broaden their democratic space? And that's, I think, the big question at this point. Many Russians who I believe understand the situation still seem to be accepting of it, and that's probably what Mr. Putin is counting on.
Well, the judge, of course, Sergei Blinov, is a functionary, clearly, and apparently when Navalny, he was not, as you mentioned, he wasn't able to put his witnesses forth or rebut anything. He was only given a very brief moment to make a statement, and during which his closing statement 2 weeks ago, he said to the judge, who kept his head down, apparently finding the words uncomfortable, Navalny said, "I declare that I and my colleagues will do everything to destroy this feudal order which exists in Russia, to destroy the system of power under which 83% of national goods belong to 0.5% of the population." So he must be hitting a chord there, isn't he? Because the ostentatious display of wealth amongst the oligarch compared to the average person is pretty profound, isn't it?
No, and it is, although it's very interesting. When you look at where the oligarchs keep their money, most of them don't keep that money in Russia. They keep it outside of Russia. And it's been a very interesting development in the last several months where President Putin asked for, and a law was passed that basically required that members of the Russian legislature, the Duma, basically give up their assets overseas, bring the funds back to Russia, or they give up their seats. But it is, I think, to my mind, an interesting reflection that a lot of Russians don't seem to have much confidence in the financial systems and the legal systems in Russia, and therefore their money ends up in places like Cyprus and London, and you have a very large Russian population in London who, I think, look to that place as a second home if things get really bad in Moscow.
Well, just in closing, when Navalny mentioned Russia being feudal, of course, a lot of people refer to Putin as the new Tsar, and there is this long-standing belief, it may well be a prejudice, that Russians really want to have a strong leader and that democracy is not entirely something they feel strongly about. I'm not sure that that's the case, but how would you rate those choices in terms of what's happening?
Well, I think it's very clear that there are some Russians who are very interested in and very much would like to see Russia as a modern democratic state. I'm not yet sure that that number has reached a critical mass that's prepared to express itself in terms of pushing and finding ways to express that desire in a way that will make the authorities at the top listen. I think that's the big question. And that's a difference I would see, for example, between a country like Russia and a country like Ukraine, where in the Orange Revolution you saw, 400,000 people in the streets of Kyiv demanding that there be free and fair elections. I'm not yet sure that you have that mass of opinion in Russia. And as for Mr. Putin, I think, unfortunately, the course he seems to be choosing for Russia looks to me like it's taking Russia backwards, not in just in political terms, but also in terms of being a bit more self-isolated from the rest of the world, in terms of, not reforming the economy so that you can develop modern industry, but instead relying on oil and gas. I mean, if you look at Russia's export pattern, it really is close to a third world country in that it exports commodities, but other than weapons, there's not a lot of things the Russians make that people want to buy. And I think Putin's course actually may lead in the future to a weaker Russia.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Assad's improving fortunes on the battlefield in Syria due to a divided opposition and support from Russia and Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Bakke, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He joins us from Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Bakke.
Thank you.
And next door in Syria, it appears that the Assad regime is getting a second wind in this long civil war that's cost about 100,000 lives and ripped apart the country that was previously a kind of the family farm, if you will, of the Assad family. What's the reaction in Turkey next door, since Erdogan has been at the lead in supporting this rebellion that seems to be floundering?
Well, I mean, the Turks are understandably quite upset about the turn of events in Syria. I mean, they never expected that the Assad regime was going to last as long as it did. I think everybody, like the Turks, including the United States and Europeans, were all expecting Assad to fall the same way Mubarak and Ben Ali in Tunisia had done. But Assad and his minority-based regime is really fighting for its life, and it has support from the Iranians and the Russians, and also now from the Shiite organization in Lebanon, Hezbollah. And they have been able to turn the tide in their favor. And this means that this conflict is likely to continue for a while longer, and nobody seems, at least in Turkey, to have a solution. In fact, I was in many meetings today with lots of people, and I've been asking the same question to everybody, and basically I get the same answer. They really don't know, and they're at a loss. And we're, United States is at a loss as well. So it's not, the Turks in that sense are not alone. The question is that the choices available to everybody are choices that nobody wants to take. For example, if I asked the Turks, would you under any circumstances contemplate military action unilaterally or in conjunction with other regional powers, even if it's blessed from outside? And the answer is a categorical no. They do not want to go in there because it's going to be very costly and there's no support among the Turkish public for this. But on the other hand, the Turks are paying a price for it because there's a large exodus of refugees, and the violence on the borders are affecting the Turks. There was a significant car bomb a few months ago in a border town that killed 50 people. Yesterday, stray bullets killed one person and seriously wounded another. So, I mean, it's not cost-free to be a voyeur, if you want, on the Syrian crisis. But on the other hand, nobody seems to have a solution. And the real problem that's emerging now is not just the fact that the Syrian regime is getting the upper hand, but that the opposition is fighting among itself. The fundamentalist Sunni group that emerged, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a offshoot of al-Qaeda in Iraq, has been fighting not only the Free Syrian Army, which is the group that is backed by the West and by the Turks, but also yesterday, for instance, they've been involved in heavy clashes with the Kurdish groups in northeastern Syria. And so the problem is that the al-Nusra fighters tend to be very battle-hardened fighters, willing to take enormous risks, and tend to be very, very good at what they do, and they're far more effective as a military force than, say, the Free Syrian Army. But they're also willing to kill opponents of the Assad regime because for them it's far more important to have a pure opposition than an opposition that will win. And so they are cannibalizing themselves. And in a way, you have more than one war going on in Syria at the moment. You have one between the opposition and the regime, but you also have many little wars among the opposition. And if you are, let's say, a leader of the Free Syrian Army, you don't know which way to look. Do you look at the Jabhat al-Nusra, or you look at the Assad's regime forces that are making headway? So it is a very, very difficult situation. And, of course, the civilians who are caught in between are really the ones who are suffering the most, because even in places where that have been liberated by the Free Syrian Army, now you have clashes, and they get caught between the fundamentalist forces and the Free Syrian Army. And this is going to create a major backlash against the opposition. So, and that's what, in a way, what Assad has been banking on since the beginning. I mean, he wanted probably this to be a fight between him and as much as possible between him and the fundamentalists, because that's a very clear-cut line of division where, in a way, the two sides are more quite odious. And he's getting that fight. Plus, he has now the advantage of having Hezbollah, which is a well-trained force that is very effective on the ground, that can teach the Syrian army and help them organize. So we're looking at a conflict that, barring any major catastrophe or some lucky shot that that helps undo the regime, that will last maybe for 2-3 more years. And so you can imagine what Syria is going to look like 2-3 more years from now. I mean, Assad controls the major towns, with the exception of a couple. They may get them in the next few weeks or months. But the vast bulk of Syria, which is not very well populated, is in the hands of the insurgency. So we may have a stalemate that will continue for a long time, with cities and towns and villages being bombed and changing hands, and the refugee crisis becoming more acute and more established in places like Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey and Iraq. So I don't know where this is going. I mean, nobody seems to have a clue. And it's going to have very serious side effects on both Jordan and Iraq. Both countries are already suffering from this war, and especially the Iraqis, who are seeing a great deal of violence that's coming also from Syria. So it's a desperate situation, and I really have no answer, and I have yet to meet a single person here in Turkey who seemed to have an answer to this crisis.
Today, before the United States Senate, Army General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, in testimony said that he had given President Barack Obama options for the use of force in Syria, and in answers to questions from Senator Lindsey Graham that the Assad forces appear to have the upper hand, Dempsey said currently the tide seems to have shifted in his favor. So apparently the general didn't want to talk about, obviously, in details in public about what the options are, but they're talking apparently about kinetic strikes. And there was a kinetic strike on July the 3rd by Israel in Latakia, where apparently they blew up a bunch of Russian anti-ship missiles that had just arrived. The Israelis apparently are upset with the U.S. where that leak came from. What do you think are the possibilities of, I mean, there's some tremendous lobbying going on in the Senate from a lot of senators, including Lindsey Graham, but also John McCain and Carl Levin, telling the White House that we simply cannot have Iran win this one. Is that what's motivating our side?
Look, I actually don't think Iran is winning anything at the moment. Assad's victory in Iran is a defeat for Iran as much as Assad's defeat in Iran is a defeat for Iran. Iran is the only serious loser other than the Syrian people in this conflict, for the simple reason that what we are seeing in the Middle East now is a radical increase in sectarianism, sectarian violence, divisions between Sunnis and Shia. And when that happens, the Iranians, by virtue of being representing the Shia minority, are bound to lose because they are the minority, and they're turning the rest of the region essentially against them. And increased radicalization in the Arab world, sectarian radicalization, does not help the Iranian push their message. On the contrary, the message gets narrower and narrower, and only gets listened to those Arabs who happen to be of the Shia persuasion. So I don't necessarily think that it's a win for Iran. Either way, I think Iran is losing. But the issue for the United States is, and I would argue that it should not be framed on whether or not Iran wins or loses, but whether or not one has to stop essentially this carnage from continuing. But, you know, there's carnage everywhere in the world, unfortunately, and this one is particularly nasty and has taken already 100,000 lives and is going to continue to do so. But is the United States obliged every time something like that happens to intervene? And there is no United Nations mandate because the Russians and the Chinese are blocking it. And we do not want to go into another unilateral military action because we paid a huge price for it. And when people talk about kinetic action, look, it's very easy to think of, you know, I'm not a general, I'm not a soldier, but I can still imagine that just sending a few planes to bomb a few targets will make some people feel good, but it is not necessarily action that will bring an end to this conflict. We have a civil war in which both sides are fighting for their lives now, and American sorties over Syria bombing 5 targets or 55 targets, it will not change necessarily the course of the battle. So that will mean that if we start doing any kinetic action, as people call it, I mean, let's call it for what it is, bombing, and we don't get results in Syria, the pressure is going to increase. The pressure is going to mount on the administration to increase the number of bombings, the number of sorties. We will lose American lives. We will kill civilians. And in the end, this is going to be a morass that we will in the end own, and we'll have to fix it. And under the current circumstances where we have sequestration, where the government has problems making ends meet, we cannot do this. And the cost is economically very high, but also politically. I mean, the United States is going to get involved in another war, with another Muslim country, and no one is going to, at the end, like what the United States does. Either they'll be disappointed or they'll think we've done too much. So, you know, we have to figure out a way where the regional countries take the lead and they come up with a solution that we can back them. I mean, we can do a lot to back a regional solution, but the problem is that, you know, it takes a lot of guts and a lot of forward thinking in terms of coming up with a regional solution, and nobody, from what I can tell, seems to be doing that or wanting to do that, and everybody's sitting and waiting for the United States somehow to come and solve the problem. And I think once they have to understand that the United States should not do it and will not do it, maybe that's going to force them to come up with an alternative solution. I don't know. I mean, the other thing is the Russians. I mean, the Russians also have to understand that they're going to pay a terrible price for the continuing to support Assad. And the trick may be for countries in the region to come up with something that the Russians will buy into. But the problem is, I don't see much thinking going on as far as I can tell, along these lines.
Well, in the broader Middle East, though, there appears to be underway something of a reversal for political Islam with the downfall or the coup, if you want to call it, against the Muslim Brotherhood, which I think was fairly soundly rejected by an enormous number of people. And my sense is that if you could poll the secular people in the Middle East, you might find that they're fed up with political Islam and particularly with radicalism. Hamas seems to be losing support in Gaza. They haven't contributed anything except dividing the Palestinians. Hezbollah has lost a lot of its credibility by getting their boots on the ground, helping Assad out in Syria. And then you have pictures of Syrian rebels eating the hearts of dead Assad soldiers, etc., and the disgust with al-Nusra and their behavior, which apparently the people in Syria reject, but at the same time, there's nothing they can do about it. There are a bunch of armed men running around. So I'm just curious to know whether, and this is, of course, the irony, that our policy over the last decade or so has been essentially to take down secular leaders like Saddam Hussein and Assad. But do you have any sense that there is a growing disgust or displeasure with political Islam?
Look, it's very hard to generalize. I mean, yes, in Egypt we saw a mass mobilization that was followed by a coup against the Brotherhood. But that may make the Brotherhood more popular down the road. I mean, we have to see, because there is always a tendency in the Middle East to support the person who's weak, irrespective of that person or group's bona fides, so to say. That's one. Number two, the irony, of course, is that Assad was very happy to see Morsi in Egypt get overthrown, because he thinks, at least on a temporary level, he may be right, that the new government will be less inclined to take a hard line on Syria, because Morsi was in the process of really cutting ties with Syria, putting more pressure, and Egypt as a country makes is very influential in terms of determining Arab public opinion. And no, it is possible that the conditions on the ground in Syria will make some people think that maybe Assad should be given an option to stay and devise a way in which Syria gets, one finds, shall we say, a soft landing for Assad that is softer than what people had suggested earlier. But again, we are now in the midst of a real change, both on the ground in Syria and in the strategic picture in the region. So I think it's going to be it's very early to say anything for sure. We'll have to wait and see. And at this stage, for the United States to take any type of action, like Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham are suggesting, I think is very dangerous. It's a policy without an exit option, and we have to be very careful of not getting involved in endeavors and adventures without exit strategy, and there is no exit strategy. There is none here.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000, and he joined us from Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.